Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
There's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town.
And we'd like to have you all with us.
And now here's Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio collector, historian, Ed Corcoran. Ed, our guest tonight is a very familiar voice.
Well, Dick, ever since we started the show, there's one fellow we always wanted, and we finally got him. The man with the action-packed expense account, your fabulous freelance insurance investigator, yours truly,
Johnny Dollar.
There he is.
Mandel Kramer. Mandel, it's great to have you here, and this show is particularly important to us, the Johnny Dollar Show, because most of it was set in Hartford.
That's right, no, the insurance company.
And you'd send in your expense account. That was the format of the show, as I recall.
Yeah, Johnny Dollar was an insurance company private eye.
Yeah.
And the opening format of the show was the familiar telephone ring and Johnny Dollar. And then at the end of the show, he would submit his expense account for everything that had been incurred during the solving of this particular case. And it ended up with the yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yeah. A little later in the program, we'll hear an excerpt from that program.
We will.
You don't know this, but Ed has just about everything you've ever done. Do you
realize
that?
He was telling me this a little while ago, and I'm delighted because I have practically nothing that I have done over all the years in radio. I think I have a copy of the last Johnny Dollar show, and considering that I did, I guess, maybe 1,000 shows a year for a long number of years, you know, maybe 15 or 20 shows a week, including the daytime soaps and the nighttime shows. We never kept anything. I mean, it just never occurred to you to keep these. You were doing it all the time. There was always more to do, and it never. We just thought it would go on forever, you
That's
know?
Right. That's right.
And
Ed has the foresight to keep the shows that we're doing right now on the Golden Age of Radio. I have none.
Oh, really?
And we've been doing this program for at least 4 years, longer than that, Ed.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed is a born collector. And
yeah.
I'm delighted to hear that he's got some of these old tapes, and he's promised to send me some old counter spies or gangbusters.
Oh, yes, we're old buddies already here. And he's going to promise me a few things, too, when I'm down in New York, so we'll work out something mutually.
Now, as our listeners hear your voice, they're thinking to themselves, those who may not go back to the days of radio, where have I heard that voice before? Bill Marceau. Who is the inspector on Edge of Night?
Chief of Police. Yep. Chief of Police on Edge of Night, which I'm in my 15th year of. And I was telling Ed some of the problems of doing a live TV show. We are live. I mean, live, not live on tape, but live. I mean, we're doing it as you see it. There are only two dramatic daytime shows left that are still live, mm-hmm. and ours is one of them. And it is kind of like walking a tightrope, you know, when you when you're out there and the red light goes on, with all the technical problems as well as you know your own problems of playing your scene and remembering your lines, and it's in that respect a whole lot different from radio. But radio is really my first love, you know. We were talking about this a little earlier. That first of all, we had the marvelous, if I can just digress for a moment, the great camaraderie that existed in radio in the early days, before your time, Dick, when there was a relatively small number of us, I don't know how many exactly, but a fairly small group of actors who were fortunate enough to be in demand most of the time. And you could work and did work 7 days a week. There used to be an old joke that if you didn't work on Sundays, you weren't in the business because so many of the dramatic shows were on Sunday.
Yeah,
you
know,
you had Shadow Sunday
yeah.
afternoon yeah. And True Detective and The Falcon and Counter Spy, which I played for 14 years. for several years was on Sunday. I think by the time the 14 years were over, we had been on just about every night of the week. And as a matter of fact, for several years, we were on twice a week. We split Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday with the Lone Ranger. I think they had Tuesday and Thursday, and we had Monday and Wednesday in the same time slot. And it's funny, in thinking back now, I remember there was some talk about Counter-Spy going three times a week. And there was very serious discussion about that. And we just threw up our hands. We said, well, this is ridiculous. How could they expect us to work this hard? Three half-hour shows a week? Radio, mind you. Radio. Which is, I mean, I love radio, but I mean, it's so much easier to do than television. Now, this past week, I did four half-hour Edge of Nights. And I average between three and four shows a week. And I memorize 20 to 30 pages of dialogue a night. We all do that. But, I mean, in comparison, radio is like a license to steal, you know, next to this. Really, you know, considering the amount of work.
Everything is relative. And only in retrospect do you realize that.
Exactly, exactly. People say, well, radio was really so much easier. But it wasn't really, Dick, because that was it. That was the medium at the time. That was the advertising medium. The pressures were there. And in many ways, and this is what I referred to when we were having lunch, Ed, in many ways, radio was more difficult because you had only the one tool. You had only a voice to portray a character with. Whereas in a visual medium like television, everybody has their own preconceived idea of what somebody looks like, or what a lawyer looks like, or what a police chief should look like, or what a hood or a gangster should look like, or what a sexy young girl or a matronly woman. In radio, we ran the gamut. You know, you played everything.
Sure.
And you had to do it all in your head and let it all come out through your voice. And you couldn't do that unless your character was right. And also, of course, you had to do it rooted in one spot. And there were times when if you had a lot of physical things to do, if you had a lot of effort to get into a particular scene, whether you were lifting or whether you were fighting or whether you were in pain or whatever it was, you had to do all these things mentally and almost instantaneously, you know, transfer it through your voice. And character-wise, we had a chance to really develop, I think, as actors, because you got an opportunity to play so many different types of characters. I played, and many of us did, everything in radio. I played romantic leads. I played old men. I played dialect parts. In a week in radio, if you were active, you had an opportunity to play more characters than probably you would in a lifetime in any other medium,
sure.
You know?
By the way, you play a heavy in this.
Oh, all right.
Go upstairs to his room. He probably isn't asleep yet, but maybe he's getting undressed. And try to get a look at him. My brother had a scar on his chest about 5 inches long, starting from his left collarbone and running down diagonally. He got it when we were kids. And see if the man upstairs has that scar, too.
Look, Marge, you said that he liked the same drinks and the same music he always did, so why...
Why did you go upstairs and look? You could tell him you just stopped in to see if he was comfortable.
This is ridiculous, Marge. Spying on your own brother to see if he's a thing from outer space.
I'll feel happier if you go up. Oh, won't you, Dave?
All right. If it'll stop you from worrying, I'll go see if he's awake. I saw your light was still on, Ted, so I figured I'd stop
there. Why do you enter my room without knocking?
Your face, it...
My face is different.
What? You look like me now. My face, that is, not yours.
I'm simply practicing.
Practicing?
Oh, don't go away. Come here, Dave.
What are you?
I'm your brother-in-law, Dave.
What's your face? And your hand...
Didn't Marge tell you that I had such abilities?
No, of course not.
I guess she didn't know. I couldn't do things like this before I visited Altair 6 2 years ago. Altair has a very interesting form of native life. At the moment, nobody knows of the existence of this life form but me. It's a mimic.
Mimic?
When a spaceman known as Ted Kennedy was exploring Altair 6 2 years ago, he wandered off alone to look for wildlife. There was a big brown stone in his way. He kicked it. But the stone clung to his boot. It wasn't a stone, you see. it was a minute.
I don't know what you're talking about. Get out of my way and let me out of this room. You must be out of your mind.
Ted Kennedy never knew what happened to him. Within 10 seconds, the mimic had absorbed him, swallowed him up, flesh, brain, memories and all. When the mimic had fed, it realized what a lucky find it had made. A spaceman who would be going back to Earth someday. The mimic can divide itself infinitely. It left part of itself there in its old disguise of a stone. The rest of it went back to the spaceship disguised as Ted Kennedy.
Marge said you were different, that something had happened to you.
I have all of Ted Kennedy's memories. As far as anyone can tell, I am Ted Kennedy, right down to the last molecule. And my crew members, who were all absorbed by the mimic and who are on leave now...
Oh, ship bugs, you're spreading all over the Earth.
Exactly. Come here, Dave.
Not a garmy!
Don't try to resist. It'll just take seconds.
What? Tommy! Tommy!
Just a moment more, then it'll be all right.
Marge!
There. Finished.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing. Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
In days of so much uncertainty, security is welcomed by everyone, especially financial security. The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank suggest that a growing savings account is one of the best means of ensuring financial security. And at Cromwell Savings Bank, you'll grow more with any one of their 5 savings plans. So begin to plan for tomorrow today by opening a savings account at the Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
You'll grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, is open Monday through Wednesday 9 to 3, Thursday 9 to 5, and Fridays 9 to 7:30 p.m.
Our guest tonight is Mandel Kramer. We're talking about the golden age of radio, which started out for you, Mandel, not so golden, a little tarnished, I guess, as far as the financial aspect of it is concerned, in Cleveland at WTAM.
That was the NBC affiliate in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Yeah. That was way back, and I had worked, I was working actually in my father's department store out in Cleveland for a number of years. Then I started Western Reserve University, now Case Reserve, and I did some, that was actually my first acting. I did some in high school, not very much, and got more of a taste of it my first year in college, and suddenly decided that that's what I wanted. So I left Reserve after 1 year, and I came to New York and went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and got some basic training there. Then came back and worked at the Cleveland Playhouse, and also at that time started doing a little radio at WTAM. Northern Lights was the first show I ever did. That's the one you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first commercial fee. I got $3.50 for it. Later, I think I got raised to $5. And then about a year after that, I came back to New York, and radio was really in its booming heyday at that point. And Gangbusters was a show that, for some reason, I'd always listened to back in Cleveland and wanted very badly to do. But how do you do this? How do you get started? You know, I didn't know anybody in New York.
That's right.
I joined a telephone answering service, and they gave me a sheet listing the advertising agencies that produce the various dramatic programs. And so you would, from talking to other actors, you know, that you would meet on the third floor of NBC. Incidentally, you know, nothing like that exists anymore. In the old days, the third floor at NBC was where everybody congregated. There were Colby's, which is non-existent now. Colby's was the restaurant at CBS, 485 Madison Avenue. So if you wanted to meet any of your friends or just find out what was going on, you just ended up on the third floor of NBC over at Colby's, and you kind of got the word there. It was all passed on. Everybody congregated there, and it was social. And also, there was a good chance to nab a director as he walked through the, you know, from
sure.
one studio to another, because the third floor was where a great many of the dramatic shows came from the studios on the third floor. Well, I found out that the way you have to do this is you have to go around and get appointments for auditions at these various advertising agencies. They were not clamoring for Mandel Kramer at that point. And I had an uncle at that point who was in the motion picture business, and I hadn't seen him for many years. I hadn't seen him many years prior to that or after that. And he was the only person I knew in New York. So I called him, and he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I want to be an actor." He said, "Don't be a fool. Go home and get in your father's shoe business." So that was the extent of the help I got from him. But I did go up to take to find out about taking an audition for Gangbusters. And Harry Frazee was the director at that point. He was the son of the Harry Frazee who, many years ago, owned the Boston Red Sox. I don't know if that name's familiar to you now. And I came up to Phillips H. Lord's office, and that was my first time I ever set foot in that office, not the last, I'm happy to say, because ultimately I was under contract to Phil Lord for many, many years on Counter Spy. But the girl at the desk, when I asked for Mr. Frazee, it's amazing, you know, the naivete, fresh out of Cleveland. How do you get to people? How do you get a job, you know? How do you do this? And she said, "Oh, Mr. Frazee isn't here now. He's holding auditions over at CBS. I said, "Oh, what floor is he on, or what studio on, I recall?" And she told me. And so I hot-footed it across the street to 485, and I took the elevator up, and there were a whole group of actors sitting around waiting to be auditioned. And there was a gal sitting there with a list of names. And I walked over to her, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, they told me that the auditions were being held here for Gangbusters." And she said, "Yes, that's right. What's your name?" And so, actually, I crashed the audition, but it wasn't really a lie, because I didn't say that I was supposed to be on it. She just surmised that.
Right.
So I went in, and they handed me a script, and I was terrified. But I got the part, and my first network broadcast was a lead on Gangbusters coming out of New York after Northern Lights in Cleveland, Ohio. I can't tell you how terrified I was, really. But that's how it started. That's how it started.
Yeah. Well, that must have been an amazing experience for you.
It's a freak thing. there was another name that actors will remember, certainly, a woman by the name of Martha Atwell, who directed a great many of the daytime dramatic shows for Blackett, Sample, and Hummert, air features. She did things like Young Widder Brown and, Just Plain Bill. I don't know if she did Just Plain Bill, Alias Jimmy Valentine. There were three or four shows. She was very active. But she was literally unapproachable. She was a lovely lady, as I found out later, but no one approached her. I mean, on the third floor, when this lady walked by, nobody approached her because she was very aloof, and she could just, you know, destroy you with a look. And later on, I found out that, you know, you never speak to her. You just don't. But in going, I didn't know this at the time. You know, fools rush in.
That's right.
And I had this list of names of people who directed these shows, and I saw Martha Atwell, and look at all the shows she directs. Well, I did what seemed the only normal and natural thing to do. I looked up Martha Atwell in the New York telephone directory, and I called her. At home. I swear to you, this is the truth. I called her at home, and I introduced myself to her on the phone. And I think she was so amused, really, by my complete naivete that I had the incredible effrontery to do this, you know. And I said, I'm new in New York, and I understand that you direct the show, and I would like very much to read for you, you know, if that's at all possible. I don't know what her reaction was, except I can only think that she must have been terribly amused, because she said, "You come to NBC tomorrow, studio, whatever it was, at such and such a time." And I said, "Thank you very much." And I didn't. I thought, that's the way you do it. Mm-hmm. So I went. I was there. And I waited until the rehearsal broke, and I went in. And here was this lady, and I introduced myself. I said, "I'm Mandel Kramer. I spoke to you on the phone." And she said, "Let me hear you read this." And she handed me a script. And it was I think it was a character called Bluey Masters or something. It was a gangster. And I read about three lines for her. And she said, all right, are you available for whatever the show was next week? Was I available? And I'll tell you something. I worked for this lady on and off for 20 years, or as long as until she passed away. And, you know, she always cast me as that same part. No matter what the name was, it was... of the character, it was always Bluey Masters. I always came in, and it was always, all right, buddy, hand it over now. You know, it's funny, you know, fools rush in, I guess.
That's a great story. She was the casting director?
No, she was not the casting director. She was the director of the program.
I see.
She was the director of the program.
So her word was law.
I would say. I would say.
If you happen to see the movie The Sting, there's a similar line in the plot where the same thing happens. You know, I did see it.
I'm trying to recall.
Where he approached the big hood, and he treated him like he was, you know, some two-bit gangster, and yet he was a millionaire. You remember that?
Of course.
You know,
sure,
the naivete of the thing, and he got away with it. I didn't mean to give him a plug, but it just seemed appropriate to mention.
We were talking, too, about the recognition factor, the difference in the recognition factor between being, you know, known in radio for many years and being identified as a character on a television program that has a lot of exposure. And I was telling Ed that for many, many years, I think a lot of people who listened to radio knew who Mandel Kramer was, but... I mean, you know, nobody knew you. You could go anywhere. Nobody would know you. Now, it's difficult to go anywhere without being stopped and approached as Bill Marceau. But I don't know how many people know who Mandel Kramer is. This is the problem.
That is a problem. Yes. Bill might be able to get away, but how about Mandel Kramer? How about Gangbusters, shall we?
Okay, this is a scene with two former guests and yourself, Ray Johnson, Larry Haynes, and the redoubtable Mandel Kramer. And again, you're a heavy, but you're actually a counterfeit heavy. You're a policeman playing the part of a heavy. You're
posing as
undercover
a
man.
I see.
See, Harvey? I'm Frankie Ludden.
Come on in, Frankie. Glad to see you.
Sorry I'm late. The plane set down in Kansas City for an equipment check.
All right, Frankie. This is Eddie Palmer.
Glad to make you quick, Frankie.
How are you? Well, Mr. Yabba, you got quite a business going out there.
That'll do. Sit down, Frankie.
Thanks.
Cigarette?
No, thanks. I don't use them. They won't mind if I do.
Now, Frankie, I don't know how you handle it with Dalbo out in the coast. Back here, I'm the boss.
Sure.
My instructions were that when you got here, you were to use the private entrance. Why didn't you...
Mr. Yarby, I got a plane ticket back to San Francisco. If you want me to use it...
Maybe, Frank, you forgot.
Well, Mr. Yarby...
No, I didn't forget. I got a question for you, Mr. Yarby. What's the money in this job?
Dalbo told you that.
Yeah, but people have a way of changing their minds from day to day. I want to hear it from you.
$1,500.
How much in advance?
You get the whole thing when you pull off the job.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about expenses?
Eddie will take care of those.
Oh, yes, sir. I'll take care of that, Frankie.
Well, what's Eddie got to do with
that? Eddie will give you the job, tax expenses, and pay you off.
Then why doesn't Eddie just go ahead and do it?
Well, Frankie, look, you gotta have a finger.
You just tell me the name of the bum and where I can find him. I'll be my own finger.
Luston, you take Eddie.
I will get you away, Frankie. Gotta get you a place to stay. Getting this bum right's gonna be tricky.
Well?
Okay, Mr. Yarby, I'll take Eddie.
Attaboy, Frankie. Mr. Yarby, I'll take him right down to South Side and get set up. We'll be in touch, huh?
No slip-ups. Private door is right over there. This button works it electrically.
Ah, it's a pretty good way of keeping two sides of the business separated, Mr. Yarby.
Where's this lead? So far as you're concerned, this door leads to the storage room, the carbon supply company, in the next building. It's the way you will always enter and leave this office.
Sure.
I'll wait for Eddie in the storeroom.
Sure.
Eddie, come here. Can you handle him?
Oh, sure, Mr. Yarby. You know me.
Yeah, he's a real wise guy. No wonder Dalbo wants him crossed off.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
The person who saves regularly guarantees his own bright future. Cromwell Savings Bank offers 5 convenient savings plans for their customers, including a 4-year certificate of deposit with a $1,000 minimum, These four-year certificates of deposit pay an annual rate of 7.5% with an effective yield of 7.90%. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank and plan now for your future.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, is open Monday through Wednesday 9 to 3, Thursday 9 to 5, and Fridays 9 to 7:30 p.m.
Our guest is Mandel Kramer, as we recall the golden age of radio. And I don't know if either, I know you don't know this, Mandel, and I haven't shared this with Ed as yet, but I was on the air doing my regular daytime show, and I was recalling to the very well-known comedian Jack Gilford the story of that Mary Jane Higbee shared with us here on this program, of a woman who was so involved with a particular soap opera that she was appearing on that she was actually making booties for the little baby that she had. And one day she came down to present the booties to the little baby, who happened to be, of course, an adult actress.
Yes. Probably played by Madeline Pierce.
Okay.
Remember that name, Ed?
Yes.
Madeline Pierce.
All
right. Was an actress who really had the market cornered as far as babies were concerned. Babies and infants, maybe up to the age of 3 or 4 or 5, you know? Well, she did all of those.
The point of the story is that Jack thought it was very amusing, and the phone rang about 5 minutes later. We're still on the air, mind you. And I picked up the phone, and she said, "Dick, my name is Madeline Gilford." And I assume it had to be Madeline Pierce, because she said, "The story you've told is absolutely true." And she did a couple of baby cries for us, and she's going to be a guest on our program.
Jack's wife.
Oh, that's tremendous.
Jack's wife, of course. Sure. Known professionally as Madeline Lee.
Madeline Lee.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, sure. I know Jack. Sure.
Oh, that should make a sure, funny yes. story, because we've right. never gotten into that aspect right. of the sounds that were
Well,
creating.
This is another thing, you know, where in radio, if you had a child, you had for the most part, you know, a very young child or an infant, you had an adult do it. And there were actresses who specialized in this and who were marvelous at it, you know, with the baby cries and everything. And I was telling Ed before, the problem we have on Edge of Night now, where the guy who plays my wife and myself have adopted a 2-year-old child. Well, she is 2 years old. She's a charming little girl, but you can't teach a 2-year-old lines so that we have no way of knowing what she's going to do. We wing it all. Now, while our show is live, we have to, for protection, pre-tape the scenes that the baby is in, because we don't know what she's going to do. We rehearse without her. And then when we go on camera, we bring her on, and if we're lucky, we get it. And if not, someday she runs right off of the set.
Mm-hmm.
And I go running after her and trying to save the tape, bring her back and saying, you know, she insists on running into the other room all the time, you know? But the problems that you have working this way with a very, very young child are enormous. It's terribly difficult because you have no control at all, and you still have your own dialogue that you have to get out, and the scene still has a certain length of time to run, you know, before you go to black and the commercial comes
sure,
in.
Sure.
So it is a problem working with youngsters in television, that young.
But, of course, those problems were non-existent in radio. And you had other people who did all sorts of sound effects with their voices. Mel Blanc was a good example of that.
Brad Barker,
yeah.
who did all the animals, and Donald Bain. Brad Barker looked like a banker. Mm-hmm. You know, he would come in, and he was magnificently dressed, and he probably would have a Homburg hat on, and he carried a stick, and he really looked, you know, he could have been the head of the network walking in if you didn't know who he was, and he would come in and settle down, take off his coat, and then he'd go over and in a corner, and start, next thing you knew, he was practicing dog barks or lion roars, you know?
That's great. Were you ever in a situation where you had to ad-lib your way out of it on radio because a sound effect, you know, the old story about the gunshot?
Yeah, of course. And classic stories about gunshots that didn't go off. And you may have been told this because you've had a lot of radio people on before. I don't know, does the name Chick Vincent mean anything to you?
No.
Chick was a director of radio and producer of radio programs in the early days. I haven't seen Chick in a long time. I know he's still active. And Chick used to direct out on the floor, you know, right there with the mm-hmm. actors. He would mm-hmm. wear cans and work right on the floor. And I've forgotten whether it was Nick Carter or whatever whodunit it was. And at one point, the gunfight is supposed to ensue, where the guy is supposed to come up and pull the trigger, and the sound effects man pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. And Chick just said, "Bang!" True story.
Oh, true story. His instincts just took over. He just couldn't allow that one to go by. What was your favorite role on radio?
Well, I enjoyed Johnny Dollar a lot. I guess I would have to say my favorite role was Counter Spy. It was, for the most part, a well-written script. It was timely. And also it gave me the chance to play a straight, sympathetic role, whereas most of the time I was doing heavies or character parts. And doing Counter Spy, I think, was... Certainly, one of the roles I enjoyed the most over the years.
Of course, Ed, you're an X-1 fan, and I know that you've got to have something in there with Mandel Kramer.
Yes, I have one called Mr. Costello Hero. I don't know whether you remember that one or not.
You don't remember.
traveling to some strange planet, and this is kind of interesting because they used bugs in this, bugging devices the size of a wristwatch, which when the show was done was, you know, really fantastic.
Are we going to hear this?
Yes, if you let us, we'll okay. play it for you.
I'd love to.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. Far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of a future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Mr. Costello, Hero, by Theodore Sturgeon. It began the day the skipper called me into his cabin. I'd been a purser aboard the spaceship Star Climber for almost 12 years, and I'd never yet been asked to Iron Man's cabin. But then a lot of strange things had been happening on this trip to Borongwen.
Come in. Oh. Sit down, Purser. Right, sit you down.
Yes, sir.
All right. Here's a deck of cards. Deal.
Sir?
I said deal. 5-card draw. Go on, man.
Yes, sir.
Well?
Three of a kind, sir.
You didn't draw.
I beg your pardon?
When you play draw poker, you're supposed to draw. If you don't draw, you're supposed to give your opponent a chance to draw. Now, mister, did you ask me to draw?
Well, we haven't been playing that way recently.
Who changed the rules?
I don't know.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you something else. You stood a watch last night in the ship's galley.
Why, yes, sir.
Has anybody ordered a galley watch?
Well, no, sir, but it isn't against the rules, is it?
Against the rules? No, it isn't. Now tell me, does the cook mind having a man watching him 24 hours a day?
Well, no, sir. You see, that way he knows everybody can trust him.
You mean that way you know he won't poison you?
Well, yes, sir.
Now tell me, Purser, who aboard this ship suggested that the cook might try to poison you?
I really couldn't say, sir. It just came up. Well, Cookie doesn't mind, sir. Really, he doesn't. He says if he's watched all the time, then nobody can suspect him. So he doesn't mind.
All right, all right. Let's proceed to something else.
How long has it been customary for the deck officer to bring a witness with him when he takes over the watch?
That's out of my department,
sir. Now, think hard, Purser. Did you ever hear of a deck officer bringing a witness with him before this trip?
No, sir.
Or stand a galley watch?
No, sir.
Or play draw poker without drawing?
No, sir.
No. One more thing.
Yes, sir.
We never had Mr. Costello as a passenger on this ship before, did we?
Mr. Costello?
Mr. Costello.
No, sir, we didn't.
Okay. Ask him to come to my cabin.
But
that's an order, mister.
Yes, sir. Let me tell you about Mr. Costello. He was our only passenger. Hello, Mr. Costello.
Hello, Purser.
Oh, am I interrupting something?
Not at all. Come sit down. I'm landing on Boringwen tomorrow, so I won't have much more chance to talk.
Well, I'll finish this later, Mr. Costello.
Nonsense. Honest men should be open with each other. Go ahead, show him what you discovered.
Well,
the Purser's a fine man.
Well, Mr. Costello asked me to show him in the space code what a captain can and cannot do.
Now, just a minute, sir. You wanted to show me, didn't you?
Well, yes.
So actually you're going over the limitations of a space captain's power of your own free will, right?
Well, I guess so, sure.
Sure. Tell the purser the part that you just read me.
Well, it's a sort of safeguard against letting the skipper's power go to his head. Like, suppose a time comes when the captain begins to act up, you see. The crew figures a lunatic has taken over the bridge. Well, the crew can send a delegate for an accounting. If the skipper refuses, then the crew can confine the skipper.
Well, isn't there something about the proceedings having to be radioed at the time they happen?
Now, there is a man who is absolutely fair. Witnesses for the watch, safeguards on the kitchen. I tell you, you're all good men here. Yes, sir, this is the safest ship I've ever seen. Gives a fellow a nice feeling to know he isn't going to get his orders wrong or accidentally find something in the food.
Yes, sir. I wonder why we never thought of that before. Oh, I nearly forgot. Mr. Costello, the skipper wants to see you in his cabin.
Oh?
Right away.
I see. Would you come along with me just as a friendly precaution?
Hmm?
You can wait outside.
Well...
Well, in that way, both of us will know what happened. I'll never be able to say that you didn't give me the message, and you'll be able to say I went to see the skipper.
Huh? Well, I guess so. You know, that this buddy system sort of makes everything safer, doesn't it?
That's right, Purser. You can't do anything bad if you have a friend along to witness.
Mr. Costello and I went to the captain's cabin and I waited outside. After a while, I could hear them shouting. That is, I could hear the captain shouting. Mr. Costello never raised his voice.
And let me tell you, Mr. Costello, that if my crew questions my sanity, they have legal recourse. But you can be sure that meanwhile, if a single man aboard questions my authority, he will learn that I am master of this ship, even if he must light it at the point of a gun. Now, sir, get out.
Wow. You okay, Mr. Costello?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm fine. Did you hear anything?
Well, yes, I did.
Would you remember what you heard?
I think so.
Let's see. You see this little gadget? No bigger than a pocket watch?
Well, yes, sir. What is it?
Listen, I'll open it.
If a single man aboard questions my authority, he will learn that I am master of this ship, even if he must learn it at the point of a gun.
Whose voice is that?
Why, it's the captain.
Good man.
But how...
That's simple. You see, this little pin that I wear on my lapel here, this is a microphone. This watch is a magnetic recorder. I just use it as a toy.
Well, I'll be done.
You see, Purser, I'm a collector. What do I collect? Voices. Voices anywhere, anybody, anytime. Listen.
A lunatic has taken over the bridge.
Well, that's the third officer.
Mm-hmm. Listen to this now.
I better not, Mr. Costello. I wouldn't want you thinking I take bribes from passengers.
Recognize it?
Why, that's my voice.
Exactly, the time you brought me the special radio message from Earth Central.
And you offered me a blue gemstone, and I said...
Hey, listen to this.
I take bribes from passengers.
Well, if that isn't the end...
Cute, huh? Well, I guess I'll get back to my cabin and pack. When do we arrive at Borengren?
6, tomorrow morning.
Oh, good. By the way, I'd like you to come see me when you put in there again.
Well, that's very nice, sir, but you're an important man, and I'm just...
Nonsense! I insist that you visit me.
Well, that's real nice.
Oh, by the way, what's the major trade on Borengren?
Glunker.
Glunker?
Yes, it's a kind of soft fur. You can make a warm coat out of it that will roll up into a thimble.
You don't say. And the Glunker trade, that's carried out by trappers?
Mostly.
Mm-hmm.
They work alone and bring in the pelts.
I see. They spend a lot of time alone, huh?
That's right. You know, sometimes I envy them. I mean, working on a ship, you're almost never alone, and the way I see it, a man needs to be alone sometimes.
Correction. Only, I repeat, only if he has something to hide. Otherwise, to be alone is antisocial. And evil.
Our guest is Manvel Kramer here on the Golden Age.
Golden Age of Radio. Golden Age, hey, how about that? Got a new name for the show.
Just thought I'd throw a plug in there for you. Who is known as Bill Marceau on Edge of Night, of course, the police chief. Incidentally, how did you arrive at that role? Was Bill Marceau introduced on the program as the police chief? You didn't work your way up?
No, he started out as a lieutenant.
Oh, he did?
And then he became a captain. And now I'm the chief, and I just hope they don't make me the commissioner, because he's never seen. We just talk about the commissioner.
You might mention how that show got started. I never knew this until you told me about it at lunch.
Yes. We were talking about...
About the transition when you were doing
radio.
Perry Mason.
And Johnny Larkin and I were doing the Perry Mason radio show. Johnny was playing Perry Mason, and I was doing Lieutenant Tragg as a daytime radio show. Then back in, I guess it was 56, they decided that they would put Perry Mason on as a half-hour daytime dramatic show. Now, at this point, all the dramatic shows had been 15-minute shows.
Right.
Edge of Night and As the World Turns were the first two half-hour dramatic shows. Ultimately, some of the shows that started out as 15-minute shows, like Search and Guiding Light, and there may have been one or two others, went half-hour. But we were the first to start out as half-hour shows. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. The original plan was to put Perry Mason on as a half-hour dramatic melodrama. Well, as I understand it, and I hope my facts are straight, they had some problems with Earl Stanley Gardner in arranging for the kind of... negotiating the kind of release that would be necessary in order to put Perry Mason on. Obviously, they were unable to resolve those problems, whatever they were, so they decided that they would do that kind of a format, but change the names. And instead of it being Perry Mason, it became The Edge of Night. Instead of the character being Perry Mason, the criminal lawyer, he was Mike Carr, and Lieutenant Tragg became Bill Marceau. So that's pretty much... how it came about, how the idea of the show came about, because we are really the only we're the only daytime show that is really melodrama.
That's
most,
right. That's
most
right.
Of the daytime shows are family things, you know, but we're really melodrama. I mean, in a way, I'm still doing Cops and Robbers, though I'm on the other side of the fence now, and we have a lot of action, and we have a lot of mystery, and we have a lot of whodunit going on.
And it's so easy to get hooked on that show. Because when I was working in the TV booth back in the late 50s, this probably predates your appearance on the show.
I started in 1960, I'm actually in my 15th year.
Yeah. John Larkin, I know, was
Johnny
still
was
on the show.
John started in 56 and I think was on until about 62.
Yeah.
Then he went to the West Coast.
Right. But I remember telling my wife about this program that I'm forced to watch from 4:30 to 5. It was on
That's right. That
time.
Was our original time.
Sure.
And, you know, incidentally, 4:30 to 5 was logically the edge of night. You were getting close to it.
Yeah.
Then gradually they moved us back. We were then 3:30 to 4. We're now 2:30 to 3, and if they keep this up, they're going to have to change the title.
Edge of noon.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I began to tell her about the plot line. And first thing you know, she started to watch. And we'd go home and we'd discuss
it. It's amazing how you can get hooked, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I tell you, we really have good people. We really do. It may sound, immodest, but we really have some very good actors on the show.
No question.
And the ability to do, after all, every day is like an opening night, you know, because you're learning a fresh set of lines. It's you're not breaking it in for 6 weeks out of town. And then hopefully, if you have a good long run, you settle down into it. You're really doing a different show every day. And doing it live, it's like a little bit like an opening night every day. So there's a lot of terror connected with it. You know?
I can imagine. Well, I want to bring us to Johnny Dollar, because we're here in Hartford, and that's where the story supposedly would start each week.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about all the times you were in Hartford doing the show and, you know, your background and how you got this city and all that.
You nailed me on that now. Well, I have to admit it, don't I? This is my first time in Hartford. Yeah. I'm sorry, Dick. But
disillusion, everybody.
This is my first time in Hartford. But, of course, the show, the locale of the show is Hartford, because this is the insurance center of the country. And, I mean, I feel as though I've been here many times before.
You made a lot of references to streets, of course.
Yeah, Asylum Avenue, yes. Farmington Avenue.
Yes, and driving around today, I saw a lot of these streets that I used to talk about.
Sure, good fun. What's the excerpt we're going to hear, Ed?
Well, I didn't really, I just picked one out that I think is typical of the series. It starts out with the phone ringing.
Johnny Dollar.
Reed here at Floyd's of England.
Georgie, how are you?
I beg your pardon?
George Reed, Floyd's of England?
Oh, no, Mr. Dollar, no. This is Jeffrey Reed. I'm George's younger brother.
Oh, I didn't know he had one.
Oh, yes, indeed. What's more, I've taken over here, in George's place, so to speak.
What's happened to him?
Well, he's been reassigned to the Home Office back in London.
Oh, I see.
Yes, well-deserved promotion for him. He'll be in charge of all foreign business out of the Home Office, yes.
That big bum.
Eh? I beg your pardon.
I mean, for running off without telling me, without giving me a chance to throw him a farewell party or something.
Oh, well, you see, it was quite sudden.
Well, it must have been. George and I got to be pretty good friends, you know, over the years. We worked a lot of cases together.
Yes, so he informed me. He also informed me, Mr.
Some of them were pretty wild, though, I must say, like the insurance on a pair of singing mice, on stolen ambergris from a totally non-existent whale.
He
some pretty wild
me.
Ones. I mean, you know, policies he never had any business issuing. Says, going back to old England, hmm?
Yes, he also informed me, yes, just a few days ago.
Son of a gun, I'll miss the old boy. You know something, Jeffrey?
Please, Mr.
He was
Dollar.
The only insurance man I ever knew. Oh, I'm sorry, I guess I have interrupted you, haven't I?
He also, George, that is, also informed me that if I were to run into any difficulties that, of an unusual nature, that,
yes?
Shall we say that shouldn't be called to the attention of the police, that I need never hesitate to call upon you.
Uh-oh. What kind of crazy coverage is that company of yours given this time?
It's a policy George wrote himself.
Oh, then I shudder.
And I dare say you can hardly call this one crazy, Mr. Dollar. That is, when you consider it will require paying out some 100,000 of your American dollars.
On what?
On the life, or I should say the return of a little child.
Return of a child? Oh, wait a minute. Are you talking about a kidnapping?
Yes, I am.
Well, have you called in the police, the FBI?
No, definitely not.
Why not?
Because the most explicit terms of the policy.
What are you talking about? What's an insurance policy got to do with whether or not you bring in the proper authorities?
Everything, Mr. Dollar.
Don't you understand, Reed, that kidnapping is a federal offense? Listen, give me the names involved. I'll notify the FBI myself.
No, that is the one thing you must not do.
Now, listen to me.
Now, please, Mr. Dollar, come over here and read the policy. Let me give you the facts of the case. I shall try to have the father over here to see and talk with you. And I think you'll change your mind about calling in the FBI.
Well, that I doubt very much. But okay, Mr. Reed. I'll be there in a few minutes.
The CBS Radio Network brings you Mandel Kramer in the exciting adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account. America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator,
yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to Floyd's of England, North American Office, Hartford, Connecticut. Following is an account of expenses incurred during my investigation of the Shifty Looker matter. Expense account item one, $4.30 for the inevitable tank full of gas. I always seem to find it empty when I have to use my car in a hurry. I drove downtown to Reed's office in the Spear building. Jeffrey looked very much like his brother George, for whom I've handled so many investigations over the years, but he sounded far more British. Also, he seemed to have the knack of getting to the point by the longest possible way around.
He also informed me, Mr. Dollar, that I should keep, shall we say, a rather wary eye on your expense account.
Oh, yes, but...
That it might tend to get somewhat out of hand on occasion.
Well, let's not worry about that just now.
And I know, now that I've taken over this office, I fully appreciate how you may feel about some of the policies George issued during his tenure of office here. And I'm afraid this is one of them.
Go on.
Well, he called me just before I called you. That is, I called you after checking over this policy, as he insists I do.
Yes, well?
It seems that he spent last evening, up to the wee small hours, with some friends, leaving his daughter Cynthia alone in the apartment.
How old is Cynthia?
7.
Go on.
When he returned early this morning, she was gone.
Well, now, that doesn't necessarily mean that she was kidnapped.
Oh, but I'm afraid it does, Johnny.
Was there a ransom note?
A ransom message, rather, on a tape recording device attached to his telephone, demanding $100,000.
Get growing. Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
When you save at Cromwell Savings Bank, you'll find that more attention is paid to your banking needs. At Cromwell Savings Bank, fully automated service is the watchword. Transactions are faster at Cromwell Savings Bank, and you have the added satisfaction of banking with an up-to-date progressive hometown family banking center. You'll like banking where you're treated like a person, not a number. Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell. Member FDIC is open Monday through Wednesday 9 to 3, Thursday 9 to 5, and Fridays 9 to 7:30 p.m.
Mandel Kramer, I want to thank you so much for being with us and sharing some of the great stories that you have. And I'm sure there are many others that we could tap had we the time, but we don't. And thank you so much for coming up and just being a part of the golden age of radio.
I'm delighted to be here. I really am. And nice meeting you.
It's good fun.
Ed?
Well, it's been great after all these years.
You know about the nostalgia cruise. I don't know if I have time to throw this in, that we're all,
oh, yeah,
a lot of the radio people
that
are going on. On the Queen Elizabeth, October 6th, we're going for a week down to St. Thomas, and there are going to be four or five of the old radio people on it, and their wives, and hopefully they're going to attract a lot of people like yourself, Ed, who are radio buffs.
Oh, I'm sure.
And we're looking forward to that.
Well, yeah, it sounds great.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you tonight by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, headquarters for personal loans, conveniently located on Main Street in Cromwell. Tonight's program was edited by Bob Girego and produced by Dick Bertel.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.